Last month, I talked about the parable that Jesus told about the wine and the wineskins. And I posited to you that it was not about the breaking of the old covenant and the inauguration of the new covenant. And the reasons that I gave would be that Jesus' listeners would not have understood it that way. He was not using covenant language in this story. And they already had an understanding of what the wine and the wineskins were. And so Jesus was tapping into that understanding. And that understanding would have been that the wineskins were people, and the teaching, the old wine or the new wine, was the teaching that was going in to the people and what the people would accept. And the difference would have been those who think they already know what something means and those who are willing to learn what something means. I use the phrase old dogs, new tricks type of thing. And I use an example, a song that we had sung that morning. And I was offended by the change of the words in this song. So I'm like complaining about to show, you know, the old dog. I didn't want to have to learn new tricks. Well, afterward, Janae came up to me and she's showing me and she goes, no, this is my tradition. These words are old words too. So I've got my old tradition and I didn't want to learn her tradition and she had her tradition. And which one of us is right? I don't know. But the whole old dog, new tricks things kind of goes into what Jesus was talking about. And he is answering criticism of his disciples when he brings up the people who are unwilling to learn and the people who are willing to learn. And the biggest argument of all against this being covenant language is that the fasting that Jesus was responding to was not part of any covenant at all. The Pharisees were fasting twice a week. God, in the old covenant, only required one day a year of fasting. So he was not responding to an old covenant versus new covenant type of situation. So after talking about that, I wanted to talk about covenants, even though this is not part of the covenant. But I wanted to go through the old covenants and show you that maybe this new covenant, which is indeed a new covenant, there is a new covenant, but maybe it's not what we think it is. We have this idea of the old covenant, of the covenant of works, is completely done away with, and now we're under the covenant of grace. And so what I hope to show you this week and next month is that there's a common thread that runs through the covenants of the Old Testament. And Jesus coming as the new covenant bearer is capping off all of these other covenants. He's not negating them or destroying them or breaking them, but he is being the capstone of all these covenants. So that's what we're going to look at. We're going to look at this common thread that goes through all the covenants. So covenant, that word, we have in our Bible the Old Testament and we have the New Testament, same word, covenant, testament and covenant, same word, old covenant, new covenant. Our conception, God set up in the Old Testament the covenant of works, and then in the New Testament changed to the covenant of grace. So there's this thing called covenant theology. And it's like capital C, capital T, covenant theology. Our nation's founders were, most of them, adhered to the covenant theology model. So what this is a framework to understanding God's dealing with people throughout the ages. There's nothing wrong with it. If there's something wrong, it comes from our understanding, from our own cultural understanding of what's wrong. But I'm not going to talk about covenant theology, and I'm not going to say, oh, this is good, or oh, this is bad, or oh, this is right, or oh, this is wrong. I just want to look at some of the covenants of the Old Testament and look at them for looking for that common thread. So covenant theology says there's 5 major covenants, or maybe 7, or maybe 10, depending on who you listen to. In the Old Covenant, works were demanded. You must obey. You must keep God's law for salvation. But in the New Covenant, grace has replaced works, so we don't have to keep the law anymore. In covenant theology, the first covenant starts with Adam. It frames the story of the fall as a broken covenant. Adam is God's ruler by proxy of the world. He must obey. Adam, of course, breaks the covenant, and so he receives his punishment. But the problem with looking at the story of the fall this way is that we are leaving out the fact that our God is a relational God. He relates to people, relationships between people and him. And in relationships, emotions are involved. So if you have a small child, and that you tell your small child, don't stick your finger in the electrical socket, and your child sticks their finger in the electrical socket, you don't say to them, you have broken the covenant between me and you. What you do is you move your child so that they can no longer hurt themselves. So the story about the fall is not the story of a broken covenant. It's the story of a broken heart. It's the story of God's broken heart for his people. God did not abandon them when this happened. This is grace. When Tommy was lost, and we were looking at his choices and going, yeah, that might not have been such a good idea to do that. We did not say to him, you have broken your covenant with us. We grabbed him and we hugged him and we did not let go. We didn't have a broken heart. I use the word lucky. We were lucky. You know what I mean by that. But we weren't like, oh, you have broken our covenant. We're not going to abandon him. And he, of course, being adopted, he didn't believe anybody was going to come get him. You know, not even consciously, because adopted children carry that with them when they're alone and in trouble. They don't believe that there's any help out there. So, I mean, that's something that he's going to have to deal with now. He's got a lot of emotional trauma that has come out because of this, but we'll leave that to him. So that's why I wanted to have that story, to bring this into this idea of the fall being a broken heart, not a broken covenant. God loved Adam and Eve. When they fell, it was his heart that was broken. When he's walking through the garden saying, Adam, where are you? He's not standing there with his hands on his hips, shaking his head and scolding. He's saying, where are you? My heart is broken. Something is wrong here. So keep that idea about covenants in mind as we go and look at these two covenants that we're going to be looking at today. So the first actual promise recorded is the covenant with Eve. We're going to take a look at that covenant. I'm going to talk. When I originally was planning this, I was just going to do one Sunday and I was going to skip over the top of the covenants. But the more I got into them, the more I'm like, no, I want to say that. Oh, no, I want to say that too. Oh, I want to say that. So I've broken it down into two. So we're going to look into this covenant with Eve pretty deeply. First of all, we're going to read Genesis 3:11-13. And God said, who told you that you were naked? Have you eaten from the tree of which I commanded you that you should not eat? Then the man said, the woman whom you gave to be with me, she gave me of the tree and I ate. And the Lord God said to the woman, what is this you have done? The woman said, the serpent deceived me and I ate. Now we're going to stop there for a minute. We have looked at this story through the lens of Greek mythology. It is so ingrained in our culture that it is practically impossible for us to shake it off. There's a myth, the Pandora myth. I'm going to just like summarize it in just three phrases. The gods, the Greek gods, look at men, and they say, oh, we need to make a woman. So they make him a woman. She's called Pandora. They give her to a man, and because of her innate femaleness, she brings evil into the world, and that is the Greek myth of how evil got into the world. She can't control her curiosity, and she doesn't obey her husband, and she opens the box, and all the evil flies out, and that's how evil gets into the world. And we have taken this lens and looked at the story of Adam and Eve and transferred Pandora onto Eve. So Eve is blamed for everything that goes wrong in the world. It goes back, and it's amazing to me to look at how deeply this permeates Christian thinking. The president of, I think, Fuller Theological Seminary in 1975 referred to Eve as Pandora. and referred to the Pandora myth as Christian. And this is wrong. This is not what happened. We're going to take a look at what we've got here. Another part that we are looking at through our Western cultural lens is this idea of the passing of the blame. So God accuses Adam. Adam blames Eve. Eve blames the serpent. And we're all like, the linear thought of Western civilization. So that's what we look at. But we're going to take a look at what is going on here and try to get a little different picture of what's happening. So what I want you, it's important for us to know this because it affects the story of the covenants as we go on. So what I want you to do is picture in your mind, you know, when you were a kid at the playground and you played that game Foursquare. So there's this grid and there's four squares in the grid. Okay, so get that picture in your mind. There are four people in the garden, four persons in the garden when God is talking to Adam and Eve and the serpent. Because the serpent was there, he addresses the serpent. So put one person in each of those squares in your mind. You have God, you have Adam, you have Eve, you have the serpent. Okay? So, God asks Adam to explain what happened. Adam does this. He says, the woman, he steps away from Eve, that you gave me, he steps away from God. Adam has stepped away from the two most important people in his life, and he steps in front of the snake. He hides the reason for what he did. He's covering for the snake. The snake's not even supposed to be in the garden. When God put Adam and Eve in the garden, he said to them, keep the garden. And that word keep is a military word. It means it's like a castle keep. You're supposed to protect, keep the evil out of the garden. Here's the snake. The snake is in the garden. Something went wrong before this even happened. Okay, so he's covering the snake. He steps into the corner with the snake. Now, he knows the real reason why this happened. In verse 6 of Genesis 3, it says, Adam was with her. He wasn't somewhere off in the back 40 and she was on her own. And if he would have just been there, this would have never happened. He was right there, standing beside her. He knows what happened. Okay, even in Job, the book of Job, 31 verse 33, it says, if I hide my sin in my bosom as Adam did. Job is acknowledging that Adam, the forefather, hid the sin from God. Okay, so now God turns to Eve. What Eve does here, we've missed this. She tells the truth. Eve identifies the primary cause of the trouble in the garden. She points to the snake. She says, no, I'm not going to hide. I'm not going to hide the snake like Adam is doing. She points to the snake and she says, it was the snake that caused me to do it. He tricked me into doing it. This is the truth. She exposes the serpent to God. Okay, let's keep reading. Genesis 3, starting at 14 now. So the Lord God said to the serpent, because you have done this, you are cursed more than all cattle and more than every beast of the field. On your belly you shall go, and you shall eat dust all the days of your life. And I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your seed and her seed. He shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel. This does not mean that women are going to be afraid of snakes moving forward. What has happened here is Eve has stepped away from the snake. God widens that rift that she has started by putting enmity. There is now enmity between the woman and between the snake. Between the woman's seed, capital S, which means eventually there's going to be someone greater than the snake. And so there's enmity between the woman's seed and between the snake. So what he has said to her, the devil, he's talking to Eve, the devil is going to try to destroy you, but you will have a descendant who will crush him. This is the covenant of restoration. God has said, in spite of what's happened, I will restore creation. What did Eve have to do for this covenant? In her failure, she stepped toward God. This is grace. This covenant of restoration is based on grace. Okay, our next major covenant, the Abrahamic covenant. So as a lead up to this covenant, God has singled out Abram. We don't know why. There's a whole bunch of legends that have sprung up around why God might have chosen Abram out of all of the people he could have chosen. But the Bible does not tell us why. And the legends are just that. They're legends. Not able to verify one way or the other. So we're going to take a look now and read Genesis 15. This is long. Actually, so I'm not going to read it all. But what I want is for you to see, first of all, that this is the original Abrahamic covenant. Very important to the Israelite nation even today, because this is the covenant of the promise of sons and the promise of land, which is a big issue right now. This is God's promise, and I want you to see, because this is such an important promise, it is in very formal rhetorical form. So the two pages that have Genesis 15 on them, you will notice that it's in chiastic form, and there's two chiasms, and they're hooked together. If you look at your two pages, you'll see that the last stanza on the first page and the first stanza on the next page are the same. The reason I did that is so you can see that there's the form. So it starts out with a covenant statement, and then it goes to Abram questioning God, and then the covenant of sons, and then Abram's saving act, and then the covenant of land. And then Abram questions God again, and then the covenant is prepared. So then the second part of this story is that same stanza, covenant prepared, and then darkness, and then God talks about slavery and the resulting freedom from slavery, and then Abram's peace, and then freedom again, and then we see the darkness again, and then the covenant is ratified. So through this document that they carried around with them to show that this is the Abrahamic covenant, you see that very formalized. So we're going to focus in on, of course, the center. We have Abram believed in the Lord, and God accounted it to him as a saving act. So that word righteousness, if you remember, I've harped on this more than once. That word righteousness is based on the idea of saving acts. Whenever we hear about God's righteousness, we are talking about God's saving acts. When we hear about people claiming to be righteous or their righteous actions, these actions are saving actions. So the whole idea of righteousness, we say right relationship, yes, that's true, but it's based on somebody's saving act. So Abraham believed God. It was counted to him as a saving act. That's what Abram had to do for this covenant to take effect. Okay, and the center of the second chiasm, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried at a good old age. Okay, so because of Abram's saving act, God is extending to him peace. Now, this does not mean that Abram's life was perfect moving forward. Abram still had his troubles. He still had his fears. He still made bad choices. But the result of his belief was a covenant of peace with God. So in Genesis 17, I'm getting myself confused here. Genesis 17, we get more information about this covenant. God said to Abraham, first of all, in this interaction with God, Abram's name is changed to Abraham. Sarai's name is changed to Sarah in this interaction. So we're going to get more information on this covenant. So God said to Abraham, as for you, you shall keep my covenant, you and your generations after you throughout their generations. This is my covenant which you shall keep. This is your part of the covenant, God says to him. Between me and you and your descendants after you, every male child among you shall be circumcised. You shall be circumcised in the flesh of your foreskins, and it shall be a sign of the covenant between me and you. He who is 8 days old among you shall be circumcised, every male in your generation. He who is born in your house or bought with money from any foreigner who is not your descendant. He who is born in your house and he who is bought with your money must be circumcised, and my covenant shall be in your flesh for an everlasting covenant. And the uncircumcised male child who is not circumcised in the flesh of his foreskin, that person shall be cut off from his people. he has broken my covenant. Okay, if you did not read this with me and look at this form, you just listen to my words, you're going to be like, he says the same thing over and over and over again. But when you put it in this form, this is the step parallelism form. Again, very formal rhetoric. You can see that the repetition of the ideas is what moves the rhetoric forward. And in step parallelism, it's always that last stanza of the three where it everything comes together. So I have those highlighted in red. You shall be circumcised, and it shall be a sign of the covenant between me and you. And the uncircumcised male child, that person shall be cut off from his people because he has broken my covenant. So what Abraham is required to do to maintain this covenant with God is the circumcision, and it's a sign. It's not a work. This is not a works-based covenant. It's just the sign that's going to be moving forward throughout history to show that these are the people that God has chosen. And then, as we move forward in this story, there is a son promised. So Abraham already has a son in Ishmael, but this is a specific son that God promises, and God promises it's going to come through Sarah. Now, we are always shaming Sarah because when she heard that she was going to have a child, she laughed. And we're like, oh, yes, Sarah, that's our main thing about Sarah. Oh, she laughed. She didn't believe God's promise. But if we read verse 17, which is right before Sarah finds out, this is what we read. This is not on your printouts. But this is what we read in verse 17. God tells Abraham that he's going to have a son through Sarah. Then Abraham fell on his face and laughed. So he didn't just laugh like Sarah laughed. He was rolling on the floor laughing. Okay? And he said in his heart, shall a child be born to a man who is 100 years old? And shall Sarah, who is 90 years old, bear a child? And then Abraham said to God, I have a better idea. Why don't we do it this way? Just make Ishmael live before you and just use him. Okay? So, yeah, they both laughed, right? He was laughing so hard that he kind of missed what God was trying to say to him. No, God says to Abraham, and he assures him that it will be Sarah through which the covenant will come. So this is Sarah's miracle. This is not Abraham's miracle. Abraham already had sons. He had Ishmael. He had sons by his concubines. And we find out later, after Sarah dies and he remarries, he's got five more sons. So Abraham didn't have a problem. This is Sarah's miracle. This is Sarah's sign. So we have a sign of circumcision as the covenant, but this is a sign for males. It's not a sign for females in this way, but here's the sign for Sarah. Sarah gets pregnant. Sarah has a baby. It's her miracle. It's her sign. She knows this child is hers. Men, when women have a baby, when their wife has a baby, they just have to accept that this child, you know, don't know for sure. Don't know if you ever thought about that, but you know, you believe your wife. But the woman knows whether this child is hers or not. In their descendants, every time a child is conceived, the woman is taking part in the sign of the covenant between God and Abraham. So both Sarah and Abraham laughed at God. When Isaac is born, they name him Laughter. They celebrate the fact that they laughed at God. They're not trying to hide their unbelief from God. In their unbelief, yes, they laughed at God, but God kept his covenant anyway. This is grace. Next up is the Mosaic Covenant, and we're not going to get into that. I just want to do a little short intro to the Mosaic Covenant and to kind of carry the thread of how God has used the women in the covenant to carry his covenant forward as well. Oops, I just lost my page. So as an intro, we have a really odd story about Moses. So we meet Moses as a baby, and then Moses meets God. At some point in there, he has married and he's had a couple of children. And then we have this story. Where is it? A, B, C, D. Okay. I'll just tell you the story since I didn't print it out, apparently. We have this story. And the story is that God meets Moses and tries to kill him. And Moses' wife circumcises their son, and God says, okay, I won't kill you after all, and he lets Moses go. And then the story just moves on. And it's just like that little incident is just thrown in there, and we don't really understand what's going on here. So one thing that Moses' wife says when she circumcises her son, she says, you are a husband of the blood to me. Now, a lot of our English translations translate this as, you are a bloody husband to me. And bloody happens to be a swear word in England. And so we have taken this idea that Moses' wife is angry at Moses for having to circumcise her son, and that she is reacting to him in anger, swearing at him, calling him a nasty name, and somehow that appeases God and he lets Moses go. So she is not, when she does this action, she is not calling Moses a name. She is following a very specific ritual. She circumcises their son. Our translations say she touched Moses' feet, most likely that's a euphemism for she touched Moses' genitals with the foreskin that she has removed. And she says, you are a husband of the blood to me. And back when I said when Sarah conceived Isaac, and every woman moving forward, when they conceive a child, they participate in the covenant of the sign of circumcision. This is what's happening here with Zipporah, Moses' wife. So she is taking that circumcision of their son, and she is declaring that Moses is indeed a child of Abraham. Now, we don't know whether Moses was circumcised, whether Moses wasn't circumcised. There's lots of arguments to go either way. Like I said, odd story. We don't really understand what's going on, except for that Moses' wife is participating in a ritual which, by carrying on the sign of the covenant, she saves Moses' life with her words. Her words were not angry words. Her words were not swear words. Her words were ritual words used to save Moses' life. Like I said, this is an odd story. But somehow, this paves the way for the great acts that Moses is about to do when he goes to Egypt. And it paves the way for him to enter into the next covenant. We had the covenant with Eve. Now we have the covenant with Abraham that has moved that promise forward. And next we're going to have the covenant with Moses that is going to move that promise another step forward. And we're going to go into that September 7th, I think, is the week I'm doing this again. So you got to remember all this until then, right? Okay, so let's close in prayer. Dear Father, first of all, I'd like to thank you for your protection for Tom, for sending your angels to guard him and fish him out of the river and everything else that happened out there. Let us remember that you have always dealt with your people with grace, and that your ultimate plan is to write your laws on our hearts so that all will know you. In your name, amen.